Welcome along. It's Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half for Unbelievable. It's the show that aims to get you thinking. People of different faith persuasions come together for discussion and debate. Doing something a little bit different today, and I'll be telling you all about it in a moment's time. Just a reminder, though, that if you haven't already got hold of it and you are a listener, a regular correspondent with this show, then you won't want to be without what every regular listener of this show has to have, a DVD of our recent apologetics conference, Unbelievable, the Conference 2012. Available now on the website premier.org.uk/DVD. is the place to go if you want to get hold of that. Three DVDs worth of material and some great speakers, lots of great content to get you thinking, and all available. And the website for this programme, if you want to explore more resources, features, past programmes, etc., premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. So we're going to hear some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. We had a really interesting discussion last week on the Young Atheist's Handbook. Today, though, Tom Price, who joined us last week, joins me again. I'll be introducing him. And a new guest, Alex Preston. Let me tell you what we're talking about on today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, Alex is the author of The Revelations. It's his second novel and tells the story of four friends, all leaders on The Course. It's a popular introduction to charismatic Christianity run in a well-heeled part of London at an Anglican church, soon to roll out in the USA. Well, sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? But we come to see what happens in the book as doubt, guilt, sex and secrets all conspire to unravel the plans of The Course's charismatic leader, the Reverend David Nightingale. So that's a sort of, in a nutshell, something along the lines of what the book is about. But we're going to really explore the book and the characters and Alex's own journey and what led him to write it. So welcome along to the programme. Alex, great to have you with me this morning.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. This morning, this afternoon, I should say. You as well, Tom. Thanks for joining us again.
I don't know what part of the day it is, but I'm glad to be here.
It's Saturday afternoon.
Of course it is.
That's what it is. And you're from the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, Tom, but I'm sure you're an avid reader. It sounds like from last week that you read quite a lot of stuff. You've read two books that I've sent you in a very short space of time. So
I'm really enjoying my Kindle, actually, as well. Is this on Kindle?
It is on Kindle.
Brilliant.
It has indeed been a 99p on Kindle for a week.
What a bargain.
Which I found kind of, well, I don't know whether, I mean, a lot of people bought it, but it seems somehow the work that I put into it. It's a little bit painful seeing it. But now merely $4.99, I believe.
There you go. Okay. And obviously, we'll post links with the podcast of today's programme if you want to get hold of the book yourself, order it on Amazon, via Kindle or whatever. Alex, thanks for coming on today. And I read the book. It was my summer holiday reading, and I really enjoyed it. I should just put a disclaimer, though. There is some fairly graphic sexual content in the book, so if that's not your bag, then that's just a warning on it. But that's not a problem, it's a really interesting read. I found it really quite gripping, actually. So thanks for it. Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into sort of what led you to write the book. Do you come from any sort of faith background at all, or
so I was brought up by two fairly vehement atheists, and really had no religious practice in my life at all until about the age of seven, when I started going to a church to sing in a choir. And I progressed through that choir and joined something called the Southern Cathedral Singers, where we would tour around the UK singing in cathedrals. And I got to sing in some absolutely amazing places, to hear some wonderful sermons, and to sing beautiful music. And music is very important in the book. And I think one of the ways that all of the characters in the book come closest to finding their God is through music. And then during my teens, I had the kind of, you know, rebellious, yes, I'm an atheist again. And it was only when I sort of felt the call to return to something, to some form of belief, when my children arrived into the world, so about 4 or 5 years ago, and I made some fairly big life decisions. I used to work in finance in the city. I was one of those evil people.
Who have caused our nation to fall to its knees.
Crumble to its knees. Oh. Only the Olympics is between us and Greece. And this was a time when I was really thinking about bigger things. And I think that one of the problems I faced was that I didn't have any kind of sense of family faith. And so it was a, if you like, at one remove that I was trying to get back into that feeling of peace that I'd found as a young chorister. And one of the ways I did it was writing this book.
I mean, the book, is shaped to some level on an experience you had of going on the Alpha Course, which is well known in the UK as an initiative run by many churches around the country as a sort of introduction to Christian faith. Of course, started life in Holy Trinity Brompton in Knightsbridge. And it's difficult to be foolish not to see some similarities in the book between the course in the book and the Alpha Course. But,
yes,
but how much is there actually, in fact, a correlation?
It's interesting. When the book was being reviewed in the press, people leapt upon this. And I thought, it is very clearly one of the models. And there are other evangelical movements that I attended in recent. Christianity Explored, which for me was, perhaps more to my taste, was one that I attended and found really very, very useful. Where this came from was, as I said, I was this sort of rebellious atheist, Dawkins-reading teenager, and then got to Oxford, and all of my friends were pretty similar. But there was a small group of people, kind of at the external reaches of my friendship group, who every Sunday night would go off to North Oxford and go to a church there and have an experience that I was jealous of, because I didn't have something like that in my life. And they all seemed rather calmer, rather more together, rather more... I guess they seemed not to be beset by quite the same demons that the rest of us were. And it was, of course, the Alpha Course. And then when I came down to London, and, I don't know, for me, those first years in London were incredibly difficult, incredibly alienating. I had gone from a small school to a small college at Oxford, where I had a lot of friends, where I was surrounded by people who took an interest in me, who, nurtured me. And then suddenly to be thrust into this kind of teeming city with, really no sense of centre.
Dog-eat-dog financial world.
Dog-eat-dog financial world. And I was working incredibly hard, and it was tough. And so when the opportunity arose to go along to the Alpha Course, I was, I seized it. And the opportunity came because a very, very good friend of mine was going out with somebody who said that he needed her to go on it if their relationship was to continue. And he was actually a fairly unpleasant character, and he wasn't a good advert for the Alpha Course. But I went along. As I say, it was just before my kids came along. So it was, I was probably 25 or so. And I went, and it wasn't anything like I had thought it would be, because I had expected a kind of philosophical way into Christianity. I'd expected, the way that my friends who did it, these people I'd met at Oxford, and then people subsequently had held it out to me, it was this kind of, really thinking person's way to get to grips with faith. And I hadn't expected speaking in tongues. I hadn't expected the more charismatic elements of it. I had come from a high church upbringing in terms of all of the cathedrals I'd gone to. The church I attended as a choir boy was very much smells and bells. And actually, one of the criticisms that has been made of the book by those who want to see it as a complete blueprint of Alpha is of course the church they attend in the book is far too high church, but of course that's the church I know. And so it was very different to what I had expected it to be. And I basically lasted until the retreat, and I didn't go on the retreat, which is I guess halfway through the course, usually.
Nearer to the end.
Okay. I think I'd done 6 weeks, is that?
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't go on it. And then when I went to the subsequent get-together, everyone had changed except for me. Because, of course, everyone had gone under... One of the things I found about it was that it was often, or almost all the people who really found it important and meaningful were people who had come from a religious background and had lost that connection to the church and were looking for a way back into that. Yeah. And that's, and I guess because I wasn't at that space yet, because I hadn't gone through my own kind of epiphany yet, I found it very awkward then to be in a place, and I felt that I was in some way, by not having gone through this, that I was trespassing on what was an incredibly meaningful and important moment for them, and so I didn't continue going off that. And you know, it very obviously meant an enormous amount to some of these young people who were doing it, and it very clearly answered exactly what they were looking for. For me, it was not quite the right thing. And then subsequently, and you know, I was very interested to see on your website as I looked at it this morning, that you know, one of the things that the radio station is discussing more broadly is this idea of you know, are we all effectively, I think it has a knuckles with love and hate on it, but are we all divided people? Are we all in some way hypocritical at our core? And of course, one of the problems when you start talking to people about evangelical Christianity is everyone has the story of the chap who behaves like a cad all week and then goes and says sorry very loudly on a Sunday and thinks it's okay. But that idea of hypocrisy, that idea of how we are all in some way conflicted, that was something I really wanted to.
And this comes through, obviously, in the book, in, as the title would suggest, the revelations. There are revelations that come later in the book of, we see things happening in these characters' lives which suggest that they are conflicted individuals. And
we've got Lee, who's...
Yes, go ahead, Tom. Did you enjoy the book, first of all?
I did, yeah. And I thought it was one of the most honest books about faith that I've read for a very long time. And I thought it was kind of peeling back the veneer of the talk and the image that can be presented, and looking actually what is the community of faith like when it's at its worst. I didn't see a close similarity between my experiences of Alpha and the course that was described in the book, but I did see some of the abuses of Christian faith described and observed, actually, in the book. The character of Lee, though, is one character who is in this contradiction. She jumps, you know, or she's as I think you described, jumping from bed to bed looking for love or looking for acceptance or looking for something. Actually, maybe she's looking in the same way as Mouse to kind of get back to some sort
Mouse
of innocence.
Is another character. You know, all of the characters are damaged in some way.
They are.
And it's and you're absolutely right. You know, Lee... I think what she's doing is she's using the fact that she's an attractive girl and you know, jumping, as you say, from bed to bed, but actually she's looking for something deeper than that, and she's never finding it, and she thinks that it's simply the wrong boy, whereas actually it's the wrong act that she's doing. And similarly, Mouse, who is this terribly conflicted character who really is using the religious movement as a way of making friends more than anything else, which obviously, you know, it is a centre. It does provide that, you know, I was talking about alienating London. It does provide a community for these people. And yet Mouse is always a little bit sinister, a little bit cynical. You know, cynicism is something that runs through all of these characters. Mm. And it's one of, I think, the diseases of our age. And I wanted, by the end of the book, you know, I won't reveal it, but I wanted each of them to have gone through a journey whereby at least some of their cynicism was taken apart, apart from Marcus, of course, who is in some ways the voice of the book.
Yes. Is Marcus the most, perhaps, like yourself, Alex? I don't know if you put yourself that much into the characters or not.
You see, I always try and avoid this. you know, I think Marcus is a kind of unpleasant character, so I hope he isn't too much like myself. But I think he's, you know, what I wanted him to do, a lot of the people, so I spent a long time talking to, you know, people who were either currently evangelical Christians or who had lost their faith or who had refound their faith. So I did a lot of research just sitting down in a room and talking through, you know, what keeps you awake at night? What worries you? Why did you initially get into faith? What keeps you going to church when you have your dark nights of the soul? What is it that does that? And you know, there's that famous Bertrand Russell quote where he says that he will not allow his fear of death to make him believe in this in this magical nonsense. And Marcus is exactly that. He's terrified of dying. His father dies in front of him on a tennis court at the beginning of the book, and that colours his entire existence. And the only way that he can negotiate that fear is through belief in an afterlife. And yet he has this horribly reduced relationship with God. He has no real sense of the benefits of faith other than this thing to hold up against.
Basically, just sort of prays, God, don't let me die. Exactly. Sort of that's his main prayer.
I mean, is faith for Lee, for the bankers, for Marcus, and for many of them, a commodity, something that they sort of are using to get through rather than something that at the heart of it has... I mean, many Christians would talk about a living relationship with God, but these characters in the book, many of them, there is some talk of that relationship, but they're basically all using God using religion as a way of doing what they want to do.
Except, I think, for Abby, and that she is, again, there are conflicts about her, and yet she manages to find a way of living authentically with her faith, of doing something that she feels has meaning. And, you know, there's a scene right at the end where she's in an American university and she has young people around her, and there is this sense of excitement and a sense that she's going out into the world and she's preaching God's word, and it is something that is her life's work. And yes, you know, certainly I wrote a piece for the Independent on Sunday for their Easter issue last year about evangelical Christianity in the City of London, so in finance. And one of the I kind of went into it with certain expectations. I thought I would find a lot of hypocrisy, and indeed I did. And yet where I ended up was a very different place to where I thought I would end up. I ended up thinking, actually, even if there is hypocrisy at the heart of this, even if these people are basically finding a way to avoid the whole camel and the eye of the needle thing, isn't it better that they have some form of moral grounding to their lives? Isn't it better that they have some form of internal system for negotiating the word? Isn't it better that they have a belief in a figure like Jesus than that they all worship, you know, Dick Fold or, you know, Gordon Gekko? And so, yes, the bankers are in a way, and, you know, and some of them are clearly pretty nasty characters in the book, but some of them, I think, are finding a way of making sense of their lives. And that's something, you know, bankers are maybe more obvious because it seems to me that the Bible says fairly clearly that we can't be horrifically wealthy and be genuine Christians. But maybe they are, again, merely standing as a symbol for all of the ways in which we have to make concessions to the world, the ways that we have to find a way of being who we're being, supporting our families, living the life we want to lead, and yet still having some form of moral system, some form of faith.
Do you think that the conflicts that these characters experience is, I mean, one of the things that I find quite helpful from the Christian worldview is this idea of there being a brokenness in the human nature. There's a twist. We use things and people, and we objectify things and people, and even treating God like a sort of cash machine, which is kind of what Lee does, you know, dishing out forgiveness when she types her PIN number in. Do you think that this is something that points you away from Christian faith? Because I find, actually, it points me towards it, because it's a true description of what's happening in the world.
Yes, I think the centrality of forgiveness to Christianity is, to me, what makes it the faith for, and, you know, maybe I'll be careful about this, because I think there is, you know, there is forgiveness in all sorts of faith, but it is the image of forgiving Jesus that to me is the thing that keeps people, you know, these, as you say, broken characters, it keeps them in the game. It's, you know, without that faith, they would be suicidal. They would be, you know, totally off the scale. It is, in some way, something that keeps them ticking over.
I mean, in some ways, it would be possible to construe that and say, well, that's just a way of, you know, them living with their contradiction. But I wonder whether forgiveness is, the idea of forgiveness is also a way of confronting who we really are. I mean, in most addiction programs, AA, 12 Steps, it starts with a recognition of, I am an addict, I have a problem, I am broken, I am messed up. And I sometimes wonder whether, without that very clear analysis of the problem, without a doctor's diagnosis of actually what's wrong, it becomes very hard to talk about administering a cure or bringing in a solution. I believe forgiveness is part of it, but I also believe that, you know, the description of human beings as being inherently twisted in on ourselves is also a very, very helpful characterization of human nature.
And I mean, I couldn't agree with you more, but isn't the problem with many evangelical movements that is absolutely not the image that they hold out of themselves? What they hold out is a kind of beaming, white-toothed sense of certainty, and that's what pushes people away, because actually I completely agree with you. You know, there is some tragic flaw at the heart of all of us that means that we're desperate for something to give shape to things. William Gibson, the science fiction writer, wrote a brilliant book called Pattern Recognition about, and all his characters want to do is to make sense of the mindless randomness of the world. And of course, none of them can. Mm-hmm. And we all need something to overlay over the insanity of existence to try and help us to put together the pieces in a way that allows us to live in a, you know, without constantly blowing our heads off.
I mean, what I found as well, it didn't strike me that some of the media has painted it almost, the book, as a sort of indictment, you know, critique of evangelical Christianity. I didn't personally feel it was that, in a sense. In a sense, I didn't feel you were exactly on the side of Richard Dawkins, you know.
Far worse and more damaging, of course, than the... Because at least, whatever one's problems may be with certain aspects of evangelical Christianity, at least it gives people hope, it gives them a positive message, whereas what I find so absolutely iniquitous about Dawkins is that there is he, you know, a perfectly comfortable, satisfied Oxford don snatching what is often the last thing from people who are right on the edge. You know, it's easy for him to sit back and say, oh, it's all claptrap. All of the studies show that people who have some form of spiritual practice, whether it be religion or yoga, whatever, are fundamentally happier than those who don't. And so Dawkins is, you know, I absolutely loathe them.
Oh, right. Well, strong words. Sorry, sorry, Richard, if you're listening.
I think it unlikely.
You talk about the fact that, with all its faults, evangelical Christianity, the Alpha Course, whatever, is giving people something to a narrative, maybe, to their lives, a hope that goes beyond the materialism, the, you know, that environment you experienced, and what led you to look into whether there's something more to life, as it were. I mean, that is the slogan that Alpha often uses: is there more to life than this? These characters, though, sort of obviously have very sort of kind of messed up backgrounds themselves, things going on in their life that mean the easy answers aren't necessarily that easy. They're kind of presented with, and sometimes the religion, the what they have, almost for me is like the course replaces in the book Jesus. That it's all about the course is the thing they turn to. I will, you know, my life will be better once the course begins. Once, you know, and very actually little mention of the person of Jesus in the book.
There is a point in the conversation between Mouse and Lee, though, where he challenges her and says, all of these authors, they're standing in the way of Jesus.
And I think that was something, you know, I firstly think that if I were to write the book again, I think I would want to make, and I think it was a kind of fear that, you know, I am not somebody who, I mean, I have read the Bible cover to cover because I felt I should before writing that book, but I have to say bits of it were a slog. and you know, I didn't feel that my own faith was developed enough. And again, I'm always sensitive about straying into areas that I don't feel that I can represent fairly. I talk to a lot of people about their relationship with Jesus, and certainly for some of them, it was absolutely the most important relationship in their life, more than with God, which is always, my personal relationship has always been with this idea of some kind of numinous but unknowable being, rather than a very human and very kind of there in front of you, Jesus. Sure. So I think, it is, but I also found, the way that C.S. Lewis is used by people in the book, for instance, the way that Lee uses these sort of medieval mystics who had fairly, well, they weren't exactly on message in terms of how they represented their own relationship with Jesus. I mean, Julian of Norwich and Marjorie Kemp being the two most obvious ones. And that actually was one of the most fun and interesting bits about writing the book, was going back and spending time with people who I'd studied at university. So I studied both of them, and rereading them and thinking about them in the context of where we are in faith now, where we are in religion now, where we have charismatic priests who are saying many of the same things, but in slightly different ways, where there are real fissures in terms of how we think about religion, about what it needs to do, about what it should be saying and shouldn't be saying. I've been spending a lot of time with a guy called Richard Holloway. Have you come across him?
Yes.
Who was former Bishop of Edinburgh, and he's just written a very moving and powerful autobiography. And one of the things we discussed was, what is it the place of churches to do, to say, to offer to people, and particularly to young people? One of the things you mentioned earlier on was the amount of sex there is in the book. And one of the things that people who have done the various evangelical movements, usually older people, say to me is, I hardly remember any mention at all of sex in the, it was carried over in passing. But of course, the people I was talking to, and particularly those who I met at university, if you tell 18, 19-year-olds anything about sex, then it immediately becomes the most important thing.
Whether or not it's focused on in great detail in the course. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll have Tom come back with some more questions about the book and exploring some of the journeys of these characters. And generally, what it is that people are looking for when they go on a course, look into religion, maybe a little bit more of what did or didn't happen to you in the course of your exploration as well, Alex. So you're listening to Unbelievable this afternoon. Today, probably for the first time, actually looking at a novel in the show. Normally we're looking at some kind of scientific book or philosophical work. Today, though, a novel, The Revelations by Alex Preston, and sort of loosely based, let's say, on the Alpha Course. It tells the story of four friends, leaders on the course, and what happens in the course of their lives as doubt, guilt, sex and secrets all come together. Now, if you want to get in touch in regard to anything you heard on the show today, feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk and look forward to receiving your emails. I'm joined on the show today by the author of the book, Alex Preston, and Tom Price, academic tutor at the Centre for Christian Apologetics in Oxford.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, Saturday afternoon. Don't forget your feedback coming up towards the end of today's programme, and I'll be letting you in a bit more about what we're doing in terms of the atheist prayer experiment happening later on in the autumn. We've got a fascinating show, though, today, as we've been joined in the studio by Alex Preston, author of The Revelations. It's his second novel, and tells the story of four friends, all leaders on the course, a popular introduction to a sort of charismatic brand of Christianity run in a well-heeled part of London, soon to roll out in the USA. Well, it all sounds terribly familiar, doesn't it? And many people have noted the similarities with the Alpha Course, but we've sort of talked a little bit about that in the early parts of today's programme. Wanted to move the conversation on with our Christian guest in the studio, Tom Price, who's with the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, and talk about some of the aspects of the characters and the reasons they do the things they do. The fact that, obviously, in a lot of ways, Alex, there's a lot of doubt, uncertainty. All the characters at some point question whether what they sort of believed they had experienced on the course really is true, whether it really has, you know... I remember the scene where they're talking about the retreat and where David Nightingale, the sort of charismatic leader of the course, encourages everyone to experience the gift of the tongues. And was that something that freaked you out when people started talking about those sorts of things on the course you went on?
It was something that I just really hadn't expected, and I actually found it incredibly beautiful. I think if it's, and I've heard it several times since, and I think if it's done well, it's a really very, very wonderful thing. And, you know, it's no different to chanting for Buddhists and you know, can lead, I think, to an incredibly kind of ecstatic experience. It was one of those things that I think I sort of made me feel a little bit awkward to start off with. As anything, you know, if you're at any party where you don't know the moves, it's a little bit difficult. But it was one of those things that I think I took a kind of instinctive... I had an instinctive problem with it, and the more I heard it and the more I understood about it, the more I thought that it was actually rather wonderful.
Very interesting. I mean, I was going to make the point that Lee kind of jokes sort of afterwards that, well, I just sort of make it up these days, you know.
But then she's very bitter and cynical. And, yes, you know, and yes. Somebody, some of them have really, you know, it is the only way that some of them really step outside themselves, step outside their problems. Music has always been incredibly important to me. I think music is one of those ways that you can almost bypass a lot of the thinking and analysis that we have to do when we're moving into the world of religion, and you can just get straight to some kind of fundamental, essential thing.
Now, from everything you've said so far, Alex, I'm assuming you're not an atheist per
Absolutely
se.
Not.
Are you an agnostic? Or are you more than that, a theist of some description?
I'm an awkward theist.
An awkward theist.
I am desperately looking for some way of finding a faith that enables me not to have to, you know, throw out my friends who are homosexuals, or, you know, I mean, even having my... I had my children christened recently, and my wife and I took thought for a long time about whether it was something we wanted to do. And one of the main problems was that the language of the service seemed to me kind of... I don't know, like imperialistic. It just seemed to be this very, you know, Jesus takes you for... it seemed much more certain and definite than I felt I was able to be, particularly on behalf of my children, about faith. And so it is a very, very tentative movement towards some... with underlying that all the time, really a certainty that there is something there.
Very interesting. You wanted to ask about certainty and... you know, what we can and can't know, Tom, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm sort of listening to much that you're saying and feeling in much of an agreement, actually, about it. And I just wonder whether throwing away or being nervous about certainty about some things is... whether we give away hope by doing that. I don't think that we should believe that things are certain because we lose hope, but yet I see an effect to giving up certainty. Do you think there are grounds for real and confident hope, if you like, a hope that actually would make a difference in life? Or do we have to be as tentative about having hope as we might be that God doesn't exist?
I really enjoyed Karen Armstrong's book, The Case for God. I thought it was a really interesting book. But that book left me feeling that there wasn't much left once you had... I mean, it was almost anthropological in the way it thought about belief. And there was no magic, or it seemed to me to strip away a lot of the magic. And it is that magic, and it is that feeling, you know, on at midnight mass. I think it probably comes most often at midnight mass, you know, candlelight, my experience, that you suddenly feel that there is something there, that there is some great structure, that there is some meaning and some end game, and that you are part of a plan. And that, for me, is incredibly hopeful. And actually spending time with Richard Holloway, who has lost his faith towards the end of his life, or has lost his belief in something that I think any of us would recognise as God, and seeing how desolate that is absolutely terrifies me. On the other hand, my father is entirely happy to go to his grave, hopefully many years down the line, but you know, feels absolutely fine with the fact that there is nothing there, that he has never believed in anything, that he never will believe in anything. He's absolutely delighted to listen to Bach's Mass in B minor, which is, you know, or Handel's Messiah, and say that they are wonderful works of human creation with no kind of spiritual inspiration behind them. It seems to me, I would find that very difficult, I think. And so I don't feel I've really answered your question. Is there an authentic hope? Yes, I think one needs it. I don't see how humans can exist without it. I envy them.
Your Twitter handle is A Better Hope, isn't it?
Yeah, which I think is part of what I'm getting at, is that hope is great, but what about veracity of that hope, whether that hope is true or not? Before I became a Christian, I was quite nervous about claiming a certainty about God and about religious reality and spirituality. I mean, I wonder why we might be nervous about certainty when it comes to, say, for example, take the idea that Jesus was a real person, that he really died for our sins on the cross, which would be a more concrete sort of claim of God's revelation and his disclosure.
But then it's all about where you draw lines, isn't it? And that's where I have difficulty, is that if I am able to say that with certainty, am I then, where do, you know, at which point in Leviticus do I draw a line and say, actually, this is BS?
Well, let's say one might not be ready to accept the whole of what the Bible says, but let's just take, for example, the idea of the person of Christ as a historical person, and without even needing to put the label on it of being a certain thing that happened, but that it's likely that it happened, that it's likely that he died, that it's likely that he died for my sin. Does that yield a more concrete hope? And is that so unattractive if it can be separated somehow from the abuses of fundamentalism?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really was desperate to get over in the book and really keen to present was how difficult it is for young people to stand up and say, I believe in Jesus. Something as you know, I believe Jesus died for my sins, I believe in God. These are things that nobody should be ashamed to say, and yet it is incredibly difficult. And the kind of unthinking atheism that is the typical response of 90% of my, you know, London media circle, it makes it a very, very hard world to, and that's why you need these places like the Alpha Course, like the various evangelical, because it gives a place for people to go and be able to say these things and not be ashamed of it.
But you're obviously, you're uncomfortable with sort of very dogmatic certainties, and particularly, you know, you've already brought up the issue of homosexuality. It doesn't sort of come up that much in the book, but certainly sex and whether, and the fact that in the course that there's an emphasis on sex is something for within marriage, and how can you lay that on young people, and is there any sense in which some kind of repression is partly to blame for Lee's sleeping around in the way that she does, and maybe the course sort of, and Mouse is a very sort of conflicted character. Your first real introduction to him is in a massage parlor, which again, I will warn anyone reading, you'll have to
skip over
if you don't like that aspect of the book. But the point is, he kind of leaves that and thinks he hasn't actually done it. He's just about kept within the rules, as it were. And it's this kind of a game, almost.
So those are two very clear ways that the young people I spoke to when I was doing the research for the book dealt with things. Either they found ways around the strictures of the church. So they found things that they were able to do with their boyfriends or girlfriends that would not, by the letter of the law, cross any lines. Yeah. Or they found a kind of comfort in breaking those laws and then asking for forgiveness. And, you know, it was really... it strikes me as very, very strange that such progressive movements as the ones we've been discussing should have what to me feel like very old-fashioned views about sexuality, about the sexual act.
Now, Tom, if I'm being perfectly open and honest, I think you've said this before, your views on whether you should be sleeping around changed when you became a Christian. Now, the question is, was it because there was this expectation that kind of essentially put barriers on what you were doing, or was it for another reason that things changed in terms of your outlook on sex and sexuality?
I think it was about seeing what I did and learning that what I did was an expression of who I was and how healthy I was and how sort of integrated I was deep down. And for me, coming into a Christian faith was about becoming more integrated. And so I think sometimes we see the presentation of this sort of system of morality and it feels heavy and oppressive. I wonder whether it always feels like that when we are inside it, or whether to my mind, God doesn't say behave and come to me and carry on behaving, but he says there's something messed up in you. It's much more serious than sex. It's much more serious than whether or not you manipulate people. There's a problem, and the problem is you don't have a relationship with me. You don't depend on me. You're not open to me. And through that relationship, the way we view the world begins to change. And so the rules that looked oppressive suddenly look liberating. I might have considered 20 years ago, as a sort of teenager, 15, 16 years old, the idea that I would only be able to sleep with one person as a restrictive and oppressive rule. Yet I entered into that agreement through vows with my wife a number of years ago now, and I now believe that those rules are some of the core and the foundation of and I don't find them oppressive or heavy in any way. They actually provide a framework and a sort of a scaffolding to be able to continue to enjoy the relationship that I have with her.
But I think, so what, can I ask what age you became a Christian?
At 23, at university studying philosophy.
So I think that, because this is the problem, that I think that often the people I met who had the most problem with it were in their late teens, early, maybe 23 still, but I know so many unhappy marriages that were, consummated to consummate, if you see what I mean, and where they're now, you know, falling apart. The one I'm thinking of, you know, both of them have lost their faith, but it was their faith from their teenage years and their early 20s that made them get together because they were physically attracted to one another, and now they find they don't have all that much left there. I mean, I'm absolutely in a wholly monogamous relationship and expect to be for the rest of my life, but I don't know that I need religion to tell me to do that, and I would have made some terrible mistakes had I had that kind of stricture upon me at the age of 17, 18, 19.
It's a tricky one, because by the same token, I know many people happily married today who maybe they struggled to some extent growing up in a kind of evangelical Christian worldview where they didn't feel it was the right thing to sleep together. But they certainly don't regret now that they didn't, you know, have other partners and that sort of thing.
I deeply regret sexual experiences that I had before marriage. And I wish I had not had them. I wish I'd listened to the restrictive codes of scripture, which sort of say, you know, keep it for one person. I wish I had.
Because I had a brilliant time, and I don't regret a single moment. Even the ones that I probably should regret, I don't, because it was part of getting, I think, a lot of that stuff out of my system, so that I am now, you know, I feel absolutely settled with my wife, and I don't think I would if I hadn't have had, you know, four or five fairly wild years.
Mm. We're talking about the revelations, sounding more like a late night. But we're talking about a book by Alex Preston, who's my guest in the studio today, along with Tom Price. Loosely based, as we've said, on the Alpha Course, though, as Alex has made clear from the outset, in many ways quite dissimilar as well. If you want to get in touch and you want to perhaps tell us about your experience, perhaps you have had good, bad experiences on the Alpha Course, why not let us know about it? And if you've read the book, tell us what you made of it as well. And if you want to read the book, of course, you can go to the webpage and find out more. So if you want to get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, send in your thoughts. Don't forget, you can tweet me at unbelievablejb, and equally the Facebook page is there as well, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. And the website address to find out more about both my guests, especially the revelation by Alex Preston, is premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
The course, in the end, sort of becomes more important than the people on it, almost. The people are prepared to make big sacrifices, morally dubious decisions, to for the sake of the furtherance of the course. What were you trying to get across in when writing about that, Alex?
Well, I think one of the things I wanted to look at. I mean, I did a lot of reading about evangelism in the States and televangelism and the way that these are corporations. I mean, they are multi-million dollar corporations, and absolutely they are run along market lines. And so what happens in the book is you start off with the course as you know, something that is relatively localized, relatively community based, and it really becomes very swiftly this marketing machine whereby it is quite willing to sacrifice the lives of a number of its followers. I mean, the lives as in the spiritual lives of its followers in order to satisfy its ends, which are, you know, kind of global domination. And you know, there is something, I think, sort of colonial about these sorts of movements in terms of the way not only the tactics they use to bring people into into the church, but then how they keep them there once they're there.
It sounds like you're rather distrustful of a kind of any church that's too swish, too polished. You like a slightly more jumbled, you know, nothing. Things don't happen quite as smoothly as maybe.
Well,
what
Richard Holloway said to me after reading the book, he said, "Of course, you're basically an old-fashioned Church of England, you know, high church, and you've seen that simply doesn't work. That people just don't go to those sorts of churches anymore. I mean, that, you know, it is in these new and energetic and postmodern. I mean, I think they are postmodern because they're taking that idea of the church as a community, as a place where we all get together and we take off the clothes of the working week and we put on the clothes of equality and of friendship. And they're applying that to a postmodern community which is global.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I find I am uncomfortable with it, and there is something old dufferish about me that quite likes the sort of wispy old priest at the front, you know, the incense coiling up behind him, singing the whole of the Eucharist. You know, it's
muttering a sermon incomprehensively about something that you don't remember 5 minutes after.
Well, the point is, I suppose, that churches want to engage people in the modern world, Tom. That's what the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, it's engaging people with deep questions about faith, life, the world, is there evidence for God? I mean, is there a danger here that Alex sort of points out in the book of these sort of becoming a corporation, you know, becoming a movement that sort of forgets that it's about the people at the end of the day?
There's a significant problem with people being treated as means rather than ends. And it's a problem not just for religious institutions. It's a problem for business. It's a problem for the way that we handle money now. generally. It's a problem in our own relationships as well, that we treat people as means to get us where we want to go rather than the beings that they really are. Historically, the church always was a place where people could come in a way that they felt comfortable with and talk and hear and ask questions. If you were to do a sort of survey of the way that the church behaved and what they did in the Book of Acts, you would find them not majoring on small points of doctrine, but presenting this broad message of the dying and rising God, Jesus and his work, and then asking people to engage with that, asking people to who had questions to engage with it. And if any word could be used to describe the Apostle Paul's way of reaching out to people and explaining his message, it would be that he persuaded people. He reasoned with people. He would go to the synagogue and reason with the Jews, and then he would go to the Greek philosophers in Athens and he would reason with them. These reasonings, these discussions, weren't just 2 or 3 minutes, the time that it takes you to read the speech as you read through the Book of Acts. They were hours long, sometimes weeks long, deep friendships where ideas were exchanged and reasons were given and heard back. I actually believe that the church needs to recover a passion and an interest in asking questions, helping people to shape their questions, and being more serious in the way that we answer those questions. One of the pieces of advice that I often give people when they are investigating Christian faith is that you should not accept the pat answers. You will be given pat answers, but you should not accept them. You should push into those answers. And one of the joyful fortunes of my life has been discovering philosophical theology and discovering some of the resources of the wider academic side of the Christian faith, and actually, rather than my finding being that things bottom out fairly quickly and you have to grant things on faith, I've actually found that some of the most profound and most seriously challenging thinking that I've ever read has been written by the likes of Plantinga and Swinburne and Brian Leftow and others.
But isn't the problem here that we simply don't have time for that, most of us, in a world that is incredibly busy, where there are so many demands on our time, when we are ripped between work and family and, you know, trying to make some space for ourselves, that actually these corporation-like religions with their pat answers fill a need, because people simply don't have the time to go off down theological rabbit holes looking for looking for answers. They want something that is going to give them that 20 minutes feeling of peace. By, you know, I went to a number of services at churches in the city run by both Alpha and Christianity Explored, where they are literally, you know, people who, and this was often during the financial crash that I was there, there are people just taking a breath. There are people who just need some sort of comfort for a brief period of time, and they don't have time for that kind of depth.
The gospel, of course, doesn't offer itself as a very elitist intellectual system that only those with the time to be a philosopher and the opportunity can just spend their, you know, time sitting in the bathtub reading great big books. It offers itself at a very basic level to those who would respond to music, to the created nature of the world. And I do believe, yes, that we are busy and that can provide a doorway for an abuse, a commodification of religious concepts and offerings. However, that doesn't mean there isn't more, and that doesn't mean that through looking at it more, we can't get something of more substance that can stand up to scrutiny and intelligent questions in the modern world. I even think that we can push through that and actually find quite a lot of confidence in those beliefs in a rational way as well, where we don't just simply have to say it's a matter of faith, it's an article of faith. But I believe those same abuses of those sort of corporate Christianity, if you like, I believe that they are quite clearly about the power of those individuals who, you know, put themselves on the television and are quite concerned that it's them on television being the one who's presenting everything. I think it's very, very clear to people who really, and yet willing to look at it.
Millions buy into it.
Yeah, I think that's because they want to.
Well, and that, you know, and I guess that is it. That it's such a shame that there isn't something that is answering that need,
yeah.
Something more real and authentic than these kind of white-toothed televangelists.
Yeah, I struggle with them too. They're a big turn-off for me too.
Well, we're starting to just draw to the end of this section. Do go online to the show page and follow the link through to where you can find out more about Alex and the book, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, or turn up in your local good bookstore, search for it on Amazon. One of those methods, I'm sure, will get you in touch with it. We're talking about The Revelations, this new book by Alex Preston, and my guest Tom Price here in the studio has been having the discussion, and we'll be back in just a short moment's time as we conclude our discussion.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. It's the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Back to the final part of our discussion today in a moment's time. If you come back at the same time next week, we've got a Christian and atheist again, doing something rather different, though. The topic we're discussing next week, pornography. In fact, for 2 weeks, we'll be asking, is pornography harmful? Looking at that from different perspectives. In fact, we'll be joined by people on the phone as well as we take an in-depth look at the subject. My Christian guest is going to be Peter Watts of the Christian ministry Living Waters, which specifically helps those who are dealing with pornography addiction and that kind of thing. Steve Miller is my atheist guest. He says there's nothing wrong with consenting adults creating pornography. So that's sort of the basics of what we're talking about, but it's going to take us into all kinds of areas, whether there are any social ills that pornography is responsible for, what about the effect it has on people's sexual expectations, relationships, intimacy, that kind of thing, the porn industry itself. So as you can tell, somewhat adult material for next week in case you have children in the house on a Saturday afternoon. But I hope you enjoy that. It promises to be a very interesting discussion indeed. Same time next week here on Unbelievable. In the meantime, let's get back to the final part of our discussion with Alex Preston and Tom Price on Alex's book, The Revelations.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Perhaps as we start to draw things to a close, gentlemen, just give us a sense of where you're at, Alex. Now, you sound like you're really on a journey still. To me,
absolutely.
I feel that I am too.
Okay, yeah.
I would hope that everyone is.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm on the Whitewater Rapids part of the.
I mean, obviously, just the process of writing the book, doing the research, will have brought you into contact with a whole range of very interesting people and perspectives that I'm sure has been part of that journey as you've gone.
Absolutely, and you know, the whole writing it. I mean, one of the things I found as I was writing it was that I was thinking about religion and faith and God so much more, obviously, but also, you know, subconsciously it gets into you. And I started having coincidences. You know, I would be thinking of a song and suddenly someone would walk past singing it. Or and, you know, so it does. I mean, one of the things I did when I was writing it, and this is kind of an example of again, the upsides and downsides of religion in 21st century London, that I was wanting to go and pray somewhere. And I was writing it in UCL Library, and there's an extraordinary old chapel just next to it that is open. And so I went in there and I sat down. And after every time I went, and sometimes if I was sort of at the right time, I would take communion there. And I'd always put a couple of quid in the box on my way out. And then I sort of thought I'd look into it a bit more, and I found it was something called Ford in Faith, which is really stands against everything I believe in, as you know, very much against the ordination of women, you know, very, very down on the gays. It was and so I'd been having these really quite moving experiences in a place which clearly everyone else in there believed totally that they were taking a very different path up the mountain. Mm. But it did cause me to go back, and you know, and I am now, I try and go to church, you know, try and go to church every Sunday. I don't manage that often, but I, at least once a month. And you know, it is beginning to get back into some form of
how very interesting. How very interesting, because just reading the reviews, you might have had a very different come away with a very different sort of view of what you were doing. But
there's a I think there were two reviews that I thought got the book. One was by Viv Groskop in the Observer, where she really understood the openness that I tried to leave in the book. The fact that it was a book about people questioning, it wasn't it wasn't what the Evening Standard called a withering critique of evangelical Christianity. Yeah. It was an attempt to understand why young people were going there and why some of the young people I knew were having trouble with their faith. Right. The other review that I think got it right was in the New Statesman, a woman called Kate Saunders, who again said she found it a book that asked many more questions than it answers, but it is about being a Christian in a world which isn't all that receptive to Christianity and where so many of the forces that act on us on a daily basis seem to push us away from God rather than towards Him.
Tom, final thoughts from you as we...
Well, my experience of courses, both the courses that we mentioned today, both at HTB and in other places, has been very different from the experiences you perhaps have described or maybe been nervous about through the literature and the book. I do think the church needs to recapture a way of talking about questions, a way of having those discussions. And I think that we're on a journey, the church is on a journey, where we are getting better at explaining why it is that we believe what we believe. And I do believe the church needs to rekindle a passion for asking questions and for laying out our answers. And where we don't have answers, I think we need to be honest and say, we're not sure, here are the questions we still have. But that doesn't mean that... That we need to throw away what I would call a better hope or a confident hope, that what we really believe in is real and true. I believe that God isn't a sort of like an Eastern view of God, where he's far away from us and we can't really know if he's there or not. But I do believe that God has revealed himself in Jesus. I think there are good reasons to say that he has. But I'm not going to go around bludgeoning people with that or inviting people to have strange, manipulative religious experiences, or going to advocate any kind of power play to get them to believe that, or push it on them at a point where they feel vulnerable in their lives, or where they are vulnerable in their lives. I believe that people can come and find out and discover, and that they may well discover something of real value. I certainly have, and I'm very, very happy to commend the Alpha Course and Christianity Explored, and I feel very positive about those courses as well.
We've had a fascinating discussion. Thank you both for being with me.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Alex. And as I mentioned, if you want to find out more about Alex or Tom or indeed the book, why not go to the website where you can find this programme, many others and further resources, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's all for our discussion today, but we've got some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming coming up in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, if you'd like to get in touch and leave me a thought on what you heard today, then do get in touch via email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us on the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well. You can tweet me. Let me know what you thought of today's show. @unbelievablejb is my Twitter handle, and I look forward to interacting with you that way. Don't forget the Facebook page as well. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. There's also a group on Facebook as well. If you search for Unbelievable as a group, lots of interesting discussions happen there. All the links, of course, available from the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, time to go to some of your feedback, and what a lot of feedback we've had to the last few weeks of shows, and I'm afraid, as usual, I'm not going to be able to get to all of it. Just to say, for those who have been waiting on tenterhooks for the delivery of the DVD of Unbelievable, the Conference 2012, they are definitely on their way now. There was, as ever with these things, a little bit of a delay at one point in the production. But I'm glad to say I've got stacks of them piled around my desk in the office. So they're definitely there and making their way to those who have already ordered. And if you'd like to order a copy, do of course, go to the website, premier.org.uk/DVD. You'll find there's three discs inside your DVD, over 10 hours of material. It just looks great. And I do hope you order yourself a copy as well. premier.org.uk/DVD. And more next week on a special little video promo that we're putting together to help to advertise what is really a great apologetics resource. Another big thing we're doing, of course, the Atheist Prayer Experiment. We heard from Tim Mawson, the Oxford academic who wrote the paper on which this experiment, for want of a better word, is happening. Now, a number of people have been sending me questions, and Tim has been great at actually directly responding to many of the questions that have been coming in from people who have uncertainties about it, not sure they qualify for one reason or another, not sure exactly what it means by being an experiment. I mean, I have to say, we're using experiment in the more colloquial sense of the term. We're not sort of doing double blind tests or anything like that here. But if you want to take part, still time to get yourself in there as well. It starts on the 17th of September for 40 days, and we're asking atheists or agnostics to get in touch if you want to take part in this atheist prayer experiment, where you pray for a few minutes each day for God to reveal himself to you. And we're just going to be seeing what happens, getting people's responses. We'll be doing a couple of shows on that at the end of that experiment period. So a number of people have been getting in touch. Christine in Shropshire says that she's frequently had prolonged dark nights of the soul because she suffers from bipolar. When I'm preoccupied with faith, mystery, morality and the human condition, I've recently been drawn ever closer to possibly converting to the Catholic Church. In the section on prayer in the full Catechesis of Rome, it quite clearly and unequivocally states that the whole basis and foundation of prayer is faith, the desire for and belief in God, the Trinity, and the real possibility of one's personal conversion, reconciliation, and ultimate salvation. So for me, it seems that there can be no such thing as an atheist prayer. It logically amounts to a category mistake, an oxymoron, a nonsense. An atheist, by definition, does not believe in God, and suggesting that they just give it a try for the sake of experiment is, I feel, to make the error of ascribing their atheism to a temporary technical hitch, a dryness or dormancy of faith, which is patronising to the atheist and Christian alike. Having said that, keep up the good work on the Unbelievable Show. It's one of the best discussion and debate programmes around. Thank you very much. And I only read a short section of the full email there, Christine. Obviously, Christine, not sure that this experiment makes sense, but here's Avril, who says, very interesting. I, for one, will be praying myself for all the atheists who respond. May God bless them. Regarding the atheists, that goes on to a different bit of another show. I'll come to that later. Derek has reservations, was thinking about taking part, but says the biggest problem with the idea of a worthwhile God for me is the problem of pain. Now, if he's the sort of being who can stand idly by and watch suffering when he's quite capable of doing something about it, then he's not someone that I want to have dealings with. So I couldn't really pray, God, if you're out there, reveal yourself to me. I would need to pray, God, if you're there, tell me the answer to the problem of pain. I discussed this with my friends at Stockport Humanists the other night, and some others felt the same way. Is this a suitable attitude to go into the experiment with? Well, again, Derek, as you know, if you're listening, you had a direct response there from Tim Mawson to that. But essentially, it really depends. You know, we're not saying no one is being forced to go into this. And if you don't feel it's the right thing, that you can't, as it were, honestly pray in that way, then obviously it's not something to take part in. Here's Kevin, who says, an atheist colleague of mine at work has already started praying for 2 or 3 minutes a day for God to reveal himself. He says God still hasn't answered him yet. He's been praying since I suggested it to him after hearing about it for the first time on Premier in July. I didn't realise the experiment actually doesn't start until the 17th of September. It's a bit disappointing. He's been praying for so long but not had any revelation yet. My colleague is called Alex and he's a good laugh. Please remember him in your prayers. I think this experiment is a brilliant idea. All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Well, just a small sampling of some of the emails that have come in response to it, but many more emails have come in from atheists who want to take part. So we really do have a good number now who are willing to take part. Though I have to say, if you have emailed and I've sent you back the paper and the sort of conditions of what taking part means, and you haven't yet come back to confirm, yes, I'm on board, just remember to do that, because quite a few people haven't yet actually fully confirmed that. But I'll be chasing you up if you haven't anyway. So that's all going ahead. You'll be able to hear more about that when the thing launches mid-September. Let's go to some of your feedback now. A few weeks ago now, did Muhammad exist? This really was... Well, if you listen to it, you'll know why I'm laughing. It produced a lot of heat. This was Robert Spencer, author of the book Did Muhammad Exist, in conversation, heated debate with Adnan Rashid. It was hard to keep a lid on it, to be honest, as you probably heard in that show. And it's really the way the conversation took place that has as much made people write in as anything. Thank you very much, Steve, who says, I've just listened to the Did Muhammad Exist episode. This was not up to the usual standard of debate. I also wonder if you check the background of Robert Spencer, as he doesn't keep the best company. Very disappointing. Here's Andy, who said, as a listener to the show over many years, I've never been prompted to write in, but last week's programme really forced me to do so. It was one of those shows where I found myself, as a Christian, thoroughly horrified by the Christian guest. Robert Spencer is an extremist, plain and simple. He claims academic credibility, but doesn't even have a doctoral degree. Spencer links with people like the English Defence League, and that should be reason enough for us to discount his views. As a Christian, I don't believe the claims of the Quran to be a revelation of God, and I don't believe Muhammad was a prophet. But the level of vitriol Robert Spencer has created against Muslims means I feel compelled to say that he does not speak for me. And I dare say he doesn't speak for the vast majority of Christians who have deep love and affection for their Muslim neighbours. Thanks, though, for the programme and all the wonderful discussions over the past few years. Thank you very much, Andy. Here's Nathan in Alabama in the USA. Says, seems I've been a little naive or a bit sheltered. I have not heard someone treat an issue with insufficient care as your guest Adnan did in quite some time. I suppose I've gotten used to hearing the charitable responses of so many of your other guests that this episode caught me off guard. I feel for those listeners that have to interact with people who are so easily distracted. Robert made many points of interest that deserve to be treated with respect. I couldn't help, though, feel a little embarrassed for Robert as well. He didn't have to take on the task of adding shame to Adnan for his poor responses. Adnan's shame was obvious without all that, although I can appreciate Robert's disappointment with the calibre of his opponent. Here's Randy, says, please do not have Robert Spencer back as a guest, as he is an embarrassment to Christians. He apparently forgot to read 1 Peter 3:15's command to defend the faith with gentleness and respect. He interrupted constantly, never stopped talking when he should have, and generally acted boorishly. Graham from Whitstable Skeptic says, I'm an atheist. I enjoy listening to your podcast, but I didn't enjoy that one. There was definitely more heat than light. The participants were allowed to call each other names and make personal attacks. I realize that it must be difficult chairing this kind of debate, but aren't participants given any house rules before the debate? Maybe they will be from now on, Graham, if it looks likely. Tim in Kobe says, you read Spencer's book, but you were pretty surprised at the tone of the discussion when he actually came on, despite your valiant efforts to keep it under control. While Rashid was not exactly a paragon of self-control or rationality either, I thought that Spencer came off rather overbearing when he didn't need to. The facts certainly appear to be on his side, and the ad hominem attacks of Rashid were clear to anyone listening, so Spencer didn't need to lose his cool and respond in kind. Here's Jeff, who says, Justin, thanks again to you and your guest of last week's show. Let me say, wow, that was far more heated and antagonistic than any previous episodes. Although I found Robert's theory interesting, and I now can certainly entertain the idea that Muhammad never existed, I don't know that I'm convinced. I just don't know enough about Islamic studies to know if the argument is tight or full of holes. But I absolutely agree that this topic, often held to be off limits, should be fair game for historians. What I noticed most about this debate was the way the Muslim attacked Robert's character and the character of his sources instead of addressing the evidence itself. Kudos to Robert for keeping relatively calm despite being slandered on the air, but also for standing up for himself when the allegations began. So Jeff obviously sees Robert's response as Spencer's response as standing up for himself. Here's Anne, who says, I found it unnerving that during the discussion between the Muslim and Robert Spencer on Unbelievable, they started calling each other liars. I agreed with your comments when you had to call them to order by saying that whilst you like an energetic exchange of views, this behaviour was unacceptable. I was disappointed that the Christian allowed himself to be provoked to stoop to that level. It doesn't reflect well on Christianity. As I say, loads of these, so not time to go through all of them. Let me maybe just come to one more. From Fred over in, I think, in Canada, says, Justin, this must have been one of the more awkward exchanges you've had to host on this programme. It's too bad that the men felt the need to engage in overt mudslinging, because there are probably a lot of salient and interesting points to flesh out in the discussion of Muhammad's existence or non-existence. Before I read Spencer's book, I would be interested in hearing some more scholarly opinion on the topic. I've never considered the notion that Muhammad might have been a fictional character, and I wonder if it is a fair assessment from a historical perspective. Thank you very much, Fred. We will leave it there. Maybe if with time next week, a few more of these emails could be read out. Indeed. Interestingly, just this last week here on BBC television, there was a documentary by Tom Holland, the historian, doing something rather similar to what Robert has done in terms of questioning the origins of Islam, which has provoked a lot of Muslims to respond very indignantly to the programme. And so... Obviously, the way that documentary was put together, not quite what we experienced in terms of the debate that took place on this programme a few weeks ago. But just an interesting, I hadn't realised at the time that we recorded that Tom Holland's programme was coming up. So maybe if you saw that as well, you'd be interested to tell me what you thought of it. OK, just literally a few minutes, maybe just to quickly get some reflection as well on the week after that. Bart Ehrman joined me just for a sort of Q&A on his book, Did Jesus Exist? Bart Ehrman coming out in support of the historical Jesus. Doug says, as an anti-theist, it was nice to have a good demonstration of how atheism isn't a dogmatic belief set. Atheists are not bound to believe any set of ideas and can disagree strongly on any idea outside of there probably isn't a God. From Ricky in Edinburgh, says, I've just listened to the podcast where you chatted with Bart Ehrman, found it interesting and enjoyable, but felt you'd missed an opportunity here. There is a debate ongoing in the atheist community about this topic, so it would have been good if you had had a mythicist contributor on the show as well. For me, one of the most interesting things that you didn't get to was who Jesus actually was and why Ehrman believes what he does about him. Ehrman rejects the resurrection, not on the basis of the documentary evidence, but other philosophical reasons, as explained in the programme. If he rejects part of the gospel accounts, I'd be very interested to hear his reasons why he accepts other parts of them. If Jesus did live but wasn't resurrected, what about the other events in the story? Did he carry out any miracles? I would assume Bart says no. Did he teach any of the things attributed to him in the gospels? I assume Bart says yes, but what evidence is there that if part of the story is unreliable, the other part is too? Ricky, I don't know if you're aware, but Bart has certainly been on a few times before and tackled some of those issues that you raised there. So worth checking out previous programmes in the podcast if you want to see some of the debates he's done with people like Mike Lacona on that. One more. This is from Taylor, says, I'm a former Christian turned atheist who still has quite an interest in religion and philosophy, and your show is one of the Christian radio programmes I can stand to listen to. You do a commendable job. However, I was a bit disappointed when you mentioned how steamed atheists have become over Bart Ehrman's latest book. As Ehrman said, it's only a portion of the atheist community that has jumped on the Jesus didn't exist bandwagon, and there are many, like myself, who do think Jesus was likely a historical figure. Even so, I don't feel Ehrman makes a very convincing case. His reliance on the criteria of historicity is something Carrier criticises for being vague and too open to interpretation. Thank you very much. And similar emails expressing that they appreciated Bart being on. Having said that, Obviously, a number asking, well, why didn't you put him on with a mythicist directly? Well, it just didn't work out this time that we could do that on this occasion. Though one of the people whose comments I played to Bart in that programme, you may remember, Bob Price, a well-known mythicist scholar, did get in touch to say he would like a right of reply. So next week on the show, I will play out part of a programme Bob recorded in response to what Bart Ehrman had to say about his mythicist view of Jesus, that Jesus never existed. So just to give Bob Price a chance to respond as well. So listen out for that next week. Also, of course, some response to last week's programme. Just haven't had time to get any of the responses on that, which was very well received. Tom Price, our guest today, with Alam Shaha, author of the Young Atheist Handbook. So we'll come to that same time next week. In the meantime, show's over for today. Thank you for joining me. Hope you can come again at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
Well, it's going to be the first of two shows discussing the issue of pornography. And we're asking, is pornography harmful? I'll have Christian guest Peter Watts opposite atheist guest Steve Miller, and guest joining us by phone as well. It should be a fascinating programme. Hope you can come back for that at the same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Until then, I'm Justin Briley, and this is Unbelievable.